showed, you know, a significant difference in higher SWR to make a heck of a, you know, they would be, if they were going even those days, SWRs are better than 3-1 and all, I think they would have, you know, already been calling up Mr. Mosley and saying, what the heck do I do about this call? And yet, I never heard anybody carry on about it. And he used to boast that this matching network system that he had was so flexible that he patented it, and it will just not give you out any information on it. It's some kind of a, like you say, internal secret of what the heck they're doing there. But they'll tell you the whole thing, and you just flip it in, Dick, over.
Okay, that's awful good news. And so maybe there's something magic of the way they set up those traps and whatever. And maybe I'm making this a little bit too severe, Fred. If you had the driven element all by itself, and you got a good impedance match to it, and then you add reflector and director, I'm convinced the impedance match is going to change, but maybe not by a huge amount. And from what Mel just told us, maybe the amount of change is extremely small, and maybe that's something unique about this design. The bottom line of all this, as I see it, Fred, is it's time for you to start experimenting. You got a darn nice antenna. You want to put it back on the air. The number of steps between here and getting it on the air is not super large. It's going to be a little bit annoying at first doing all this fiddling. But nothing's going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. If you don't get it working right at first, keep trying. That's the Edisonian approach. You remember what Mr. Edison said when a newspaper reporter came to him and said, hey, you're trying to make an electronic light bulb. How's it going? And his answer was, well, I know 3,221 things that don't work, and I'm going to try a few more. KC2, oh, yes, K2LIW, TechNet.
Do I?
Ceiling CDL.
Andy recognized, but Fred first. Go ahead, Fred.
Okay, well, I reverse engineered the whole antenna because I got it in pieces. I identified it. They went that far with me on the phone. They helped me, determine what it exactly was. But he just beat around the bush. He would not tell me what the feed point consisted of, length, or what it looked like, or measurements, or anything. I had enough of measurements with the documents I was able to obtain to assemble the antenna. Actually, I rebuilt one of the coils because it was broken internally, and I had to disassemble it. Another friend gave me two coils that had the right forms in them. The form is what was broken, actually. 10-gauge aluminum wire. So many turns on each end for each particular coil, which there's six of them. But they also, it's still made today. It's about an $800 antenna, which I got for nothing. There's the work kits, the work bands that are available, 17, and I don't remember the other bands. But there's at least four or five other bands that could be actually added to that antenna with these kits that they sell. This antenna is 50 years old, but it's in very good condition. And I'm going to experiment. Now, before I leave this whole thing, let me drop real quick. Antenna, can I suspend it from a fiberglass, basically a crane or a boom truck, that's a fiberglass boom? If I suspended it, say, I don't know, 15 feet off the ground, would that be a good start, or would I have to just put it on a mast and put it up in the air? Back to you.
EYN. I'm convinced that 15 feet is more than enough, and it doesn't have to be a fiberglass mast. That horizontally polarized Yagi will not see vertical chunks of metal. So you could arrange for a vertical piece of mast. It doesn't have to be a hydraulic boom truck or anything that elaborate. Just a vertical piece of mast that you mount it on. And as you move the antenna closer to the ground is going to give you a little bit more disturbance. 10 or 15 feet in the air is going to give you the 95% answer, in my opinion. Let's see what Andy's got to say. He wanted to give us some words on this. Of A2CDL, A2RIW.
Yeah, hi, Dick. I just turned it on. I just need to know, what's Fred's problem? What are you looking for? Because maybe I can give him some information.
He owns a Mosley Charlie Lima 33 mic, CL33M, Mosley 3-element Yagi, made for 10 12, and 15 meters. The driven element assembly, which has got a coaxial cable that shoves down the inside of the driven element rods themselves, that's missing, and he's got to reconstruct that. So he's trying to reconstruct the driven element of that Mosley beam, and because we're unable to get the information from Mosley, they consider it proprietary. He's going to have to find it experimentally, unless he can find somebody with that exact beam who's willing to disassemble it and tell him what's in there. Over to you, Andy.
Dick?
All right, let me see if I have it. Two things. I have it mostly up on my tower, but it's a TA-33, not the CM. But the good news, I believe, I'm pretty sure I have the book on that. I have the original documentation with all the dimensions that I acquired, I forget where. And I also know someone who owns that antenna. I just spoke to the guy, too, and I got a distinct back who it was that I spoke to. So I think I can get him the information he's looking for.
So far, what we believe is that the documentation supplied by Mosley on that series of beams tells you everything about where the traps go on everything, but it does not give the description of the feed, impedance, matching assembly of the driven element. They consider that proprietary. It's their special sauce, their magic secret, whatever. We think that information, if you don't have the real physical antenna in front of you and willing to disassemble it, we think you can't get that info. You can talk to the Mosley company directly. They'll tell you everything you want to know except how that driven element is fed. Back to you, Andy, for any comments on that.
My understanding, the match that they use is a modified Q match, because that's what they use on my antenna, which is simply just a length of tubing that goes between the coax feeds, which in my case it's LMR400 that I'm supplying it with. And two aluminum rods that connect to the elements at a certain location, at a certain feed point or impedance point. I think that's the way they do it inside the. That's what I remember from reading about it a while back, and it's something similar to that. I gotta think back, but I'm pretty sure that's it.
Now, I know what a gamma match is, I know what a T match is, I know what a delta match is, I know what a folded dipole is. What is a Q match, Andy?
I guess it's a word that they use in the military, going way back to the 1940s. I think basically it is a gamma match, but it's a little bit of a different configuration. It's hard to describe, but I was reading myself because I was curious, you know, why do they call it a Q match? And that's what Mosley calls it. It's basically a military word, but it's sort of similar to a gamma match, but slightly different.
If I started off with a gamma match, what would I add or subtract to make it into a Q match?
Basically, the capacitive leg of the what would you call it now? I'm trying to think of the word. The element that's connected to the driven element itself, the length of tubing. I gotta think back. There's a capacitor at one end, and that is not there. There is no. It's just a straight length of tubing connected to the radiating element. I'll have to look it up, and I'll get the book on it because it explains this actually in the book that I have in my owner's manual. It mentions that and talks about it.
Okay, maybe I can help a little bit. Assume now that I've got an ordinary dipole connected in the center. It's a shorted left side and right side are connected together in the center. parallel to it, I've got the so-called gamma rod. The gamma rod goes from the center conductor of the transmission line, and it goes about 20 or 25% parallel to the driven element, off on one side, and then curves over and connects to the driven element. But it doesn't connect directly. The so-called gamma rod really is two telescoping pieces of tubing with a dielectric material in between that becomes a distributed linear capacitor. So that's a gamma rod, a gamma feed. So it's two telescoping pieces of tubing constitutes the gamma rod and the gamma feed, and the center conductor of the two telescoping pieces, that's what connects to the driven element directly. The outer is the one that connects to the center conductor of the transmission line. Now, that's gamma. How would I change that to make it into a Q?
There is no dielectric, there is no capacitor between the gamma rod and the driven element. It's connected directly to it. Electrically connected to it, there is no capacitor.
Okay, I can understand that. What the gamma rod capacitor is doing is canceling the inductance of the gamma rod. Now, the gamma rod is still going to have inductance. If I'm willing to readjust the driven element to make it capacitive, which means I make the driven element a little bit shorter, I've now recreated that capacitor just that you don't see it. So if I make the driven element a little bit shorter, and I've got a shorter gamma capacitor, I'm back in resonance and feeding it correctly. Anyone have any further comments on this? Give me a call, that is right now. Go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, I had a question for Andy. I've seen a match similar to what he's describing, but it actually had two elements. So gamma is normally on a driven element that's connected electrically or galvanically grounded attaching rod directly to the driven element. I was just wondering if that's what Andy was describing. Back over
to
you, Ben.
If you've got a gamma rod to the left and to the right, it's beginning to sound very close to a T match, isn't it, Glenn?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking what it was. I mean, I've seen them, they're pretty popular, they've been around, and the way they were describing it, because once you eliminate the capacitor, you're pretty much...
You've got it, Andy.
Okay, well, actually, you know, you're right. It's more closely related to a T-match, even though they call it a Q-match. And I think the only reason why they're using that terminology is because of military specifications when they called it a Q-match. And I read that somewhere on the internet when I was curious, what is a Q-match? I will say it's closely and looks almost like a T-match. There are two rods that connect to the driven element and then go to a center insulator where the coax feed is connected to. So the coax does not connect directly to the driven element. It goes to a length of rod, which makes up the feed point match to that driven element. And there was supposed to be two of them, one for, as a dipole needs, one for each leg. Take that to you.
Is there a balancing device, or is the shield of the feed line going to one side and the semiconductor going to the other side, then, Andy?
They require no balance to be used with the antenna. In fact, they emphasize that. The shield goes to one element, and the center conductor goes to the other element directly through the Q-match stub that I'm talking about.
Okay, that's the one you're feeding, which maybe is different than Fred. So Fred, I think you're going to have to start doing some experimenting, considering the price is right, it's an expensive antenna in good shape. I think it's worth some hours of experimenting. Back to you, Fred, for any other further comments.
Okay, well, I'm not familiar with what the Q-match is. I'm going to have to look that up. And I wish I had a visual. See, I'm a visual person, actually. And, I'm trying to avoid actually purchasing this particular part from them simply because it annoyed me because he wasn't willing to share. You know, I was willing to buy other parts. There are a few other parts that I can probably find if I look hard enough. I need a boom, for instance. I re-engineered the insulator. Stuff came together. I just don't know how to feed it properly. So, okay. I thank you for your time, and I'll turn it back to you. K2RIW, please.
2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, I think you're going to find it, Fred. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just one suggestion. I mean, if you go down the route where you're not going to...
You're absolutely right, Glenn. And on one frequency, that would work like a charm. But it's probably not the technique that Mosley used to make it work on three bands, 10, 12, and 15. One band at a time, you're absolutely right. But to get it to fly on all three bands, I think Fred's going to have to think.
Dick?
Go ahead, Andy.
Why do you say 10, 12, and 15? Isn't 10, 15, and 20?
Correct.
Okay, I thought I heard him say 10, 12, and 15. Maybe he said 10, 15, and 20. Back to you, Fred. What frequencies is it on?
It is 10, 15, 20. I tried to correct it.
Okay, my mistake. But still, it's three bands. So until he finds what Mosley did, any of the normal techniques we use, I think, are not going to give him all three bands with reasonable VISWAR. Maybe he's got an antenna tuner. He can live with that. But on some of those bands, if he doesn't use the Mosley technique, which obviously they think it's a real big secret and it's something unusual, or they wouldn't be fighting so hard to keep it a secret. And the real mechanism by which they do it is internal to the driven element. So he's going to have to experimentally find out what Mosley did in order to get the three bands to operate pretty well. That's a guess on my part. But when Fred comes back next week, we'll find out a little bit more about that. And if you have any further comments on this before we go on to Joe, give me your call letters right now.
Just one more comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Grant, this isn't a Mosley.
Okay, that does sound like a pretty good suggestion. So if Fred goes to the 10-meter band first, the highest band first, and the phone portion of the band, and he finds a match, there's a medium good chance on your experience, Glenn, that Fred will find that the 15 and 20 will also work. Next week we'll find out when Fred comes back. Joe, WA2RYY, I believe when you signed in you had a question, and we're ready for your question. You got it, Joe.
Okay, good evening, Dick. WA2RYY here. The question I have is, I'd like to get the information from you of how, this is going back a couple of tech nets ago about the checking my microwave oven as far as the efficiency of it. Would it be possible to get the formulas and oil conversions, whatever is necessary, to be able to take those, that kind of measurement myself? I don't expect over here, I don't think you can email it to me or something like that. That would be great. Is that a possibility?
Not easily. I thought you and I had some email conversation on this one. I'm not sure. Maybe the email I sent didn't get to you. Rather than feed you a bucket of fish, I'd rather teach you how to go fishing. What you're trying to measure is how many watts are coming out of the microwave tube when you run it for a known length of time. So you're really asking for how many watts for how many seconds. So step number one is, if the magnetron tube put out 1 watt for 1 second, that's called 1 joule. A watt second is a joule. So if you turned it on for some given number of seconds, 60 seconds, and you have a known amount of volume of water in the microwave oven, water is a beautiful absorber of microwaves. So of all the microwaves that tube generates, the water is going to absorb 99% of them. So if you have a known amount of water, 100 grams of water, 1 cup of water, 1 quart of water, a known amount of water, and a known number of seconds of operating the oven, and you measure the temperature of the water before you run the microwave oven, and you measure the temperature of the water after you measure, after you run the microwave oven, and you know the temperature rise, I'm going to pick some numbers out of the air. If your 1 quart of water went up by 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and you convert that to centigrade, there's a way of figuring out how many joules of energy, and it, unfortunately, we've got a conversion problem here. Heating of water, they call it BTUs. But there's a conversion between BTUs and joules, and each joule is 1 watt second. So a known amount of water rising some number of degrees Fahrenheit or centigrade is a known number of watt seconds going into the water. And if your answer turns out to be 1,000 watt seconds, and you ran it for 100 seconds, then you know 10 watts on average was going in there. I think you see the process. By way of Google, you can easily ask Google,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Many good physics books will tell you, and many good conversion tables, and the reference data for radio engineers, and many Google sites will tell you how many watt seconds is a joule, or that's a one-to-one relationship. How many joules or watt seconds is in a BTU? Each BTU is, I think it's 1 pound of water, 1 degree Fahrenheit. Or each calorie is 1 degree centigrade, one gram of water. For a small calorie, and a kilocalorie is a kilogram of water. It's a matter of knowing the amount of water, knowing the amount of temperature rise, and knowing the number of seconds you'll operate the oven, and doing a conversion. You'll eventually figure out what is the average number of watts. It's a conversion problem. I'll turn it back to Joe and see if you understand the concept first. But H-U-L-Y-Y, H-U-L-I-W.
Yes, I understand the concept of what you're speaking about. You're applying so much energy, it's applying so much temperature rise in the test device of the test, which in this case is water. And from that, you can deduce how much energy the appliance is putting out. I do understand what you're talking about, but I don't know the formulas of how to do this. I guess I'm going to have to just go on the internet and find out myself.
Yeah, I recommend you do that. I'm not volunteering to do that whole process right now. it's a little bit beyond what I'm willing to volunteer. I know what I've got to do in the next few days. I can't volunteer to do that. You'll be unhappy because it'll be so darn delayed before I finally get to you. So I can't promise I'm going to do that. And by the way, as you do that lookup with Google and you find out these conversions, it'll eventually come together. It's a relatively straightforward problem in physics because conservation of energy says whatever amount of energy comes out of that tube, you assume all of it's going into the water. And so there's a predictable amount of temperature rise of the water when you know the amount of water for a given amount of energy coming out of the tube. So you'll eventually put that all together. And after you find out as many of those conversions as you've got, and maybe I'll, if there's a little bit of time left over at the TechNet tonight, I'll go to my handheld calculator, which has got my Hewlett-Packard HP50, I think it is, has all those conversions built into it. You just have to put on one line joules, on the next line BTUs. It'll tell you how many BTUs there are per joule. HP50G. All that's built into the machine. I don't even have to go to the internet, but I've got to find the right subroutine program in the machine to get to it and so on. You can see why I'm a little bit slow to volunteer for that right now. Any other things you'd like to know about, Joe? I know you didn't get an answer on that one. But H-U-L-Y-Y, T-Q-L-I-W in the TechNet.
I don't always expect an answer. Sometimes I can't get an answer over here, but that's okay. The second thing I want to know is a couple of seconds ago, there's a bunch of, you talk about the oil heat efficiency and stuff like that. There's a few guys that checked in that were in the particular business. I'd like to be able to contact some of these guys, and I don't remember the list of who they happen to be. There's a couple of different guys that checked on. I don't think you'd know or remember who they are at this point either. What I'm asking is anybody who was on that particular TechNet at the time who's listening now, I'd like you to contact me because I'm interested in buying your services, so to speak, for that type of work. I'm looking for somebody reliable who's not going to basically give me the business. I could be contacted at email pegasus-789@hotmail.com, or you can drop me a letter at my call letters at qrz.com.
Joseph, you mailed me an email with that question. I gave you the list of those call letters of those people, and I sent it back to the email you sent to me. You've got that information.
Okay, I'll have to check my records and see where that went. Okay, thank you, Dick. That'll be it for now.
That email was sent from WK2RIW to WA2RYY, July 25th, 2008. That email was sent to you at 10:34 a.m. on July 25th. The name of that email says K2RIW : Oil Service Guys. And it was sent to WH2RYY at optonline.net. Is that a valid email for you? It didn't bounce.
Yes, that's correct. That is a valid email. I don't understand why I couldn't remember that if you did something that a couple of months ago, but I'll have to check my email to see where that went. Thank you.
And in that email, I listed 7 call letters of the guys who signed in that night who had knowledge on oil burner service.
Okay. Thank you. WA2RYY clear. Listening.
Okay. Another almost happy customer. Now, the person who just signed in later with Phil, N2 Romeo Victor Papa. You got it, Phil. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, maybe Phil's not there. Got called away. Mel, it's time to open your mailbag. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, all right? I saw somebody else wanted to ask a question. First of all, is Paul available before we start? Maybe Paul would like to say something about what's going on in the upper atmosphere, better known as outer space. Or do you think...
Well, let's give Paul a call. Whiskey Sierra 2 November, K2RIW. You there, Paul? Okay, I think Paul's off doing other things, so it looks like it's just you and me, yes, Mel.
Hey, very good. This is K2KEY. All right, just coming through here while you're talking to see if I can find some things of interest. I guess some of this stuff is a lot too much detail to get involved with on this. TechNet or for me to personally answer or for Dick even booking. So, we can't get into some of these. Oh, okay, here's one of, all right, I'm looking for one for people at entry level, basically. Let me let it drop for a second. Okay, here's one. I'd like to do some home brewing. And I see that many of the modern homebrew circuits use the new technology called SMT, I think. Surface mounted technology. Yeah, I believe that's what you're trying to say. Have you ever worked with it? Have you ever made printed boards? What are your experiences with SM? He's using a long letter here, close to your T. Okay, SMT. Dick, over.
Yeah, I've worked with those now for 5 years, and it's an art form. With rare exception, you're going to have a fair amount of grief doing surface mount components, unless you're using the really big ones, the 1206s. By the way, there's a set of numbers indicating the size of the resistors and the size of the capacitors that are used on surface mount components. Surface mount components have no leads. It's just a rectangular chunk of stuff with a connector, with a silver-plated, what looks like a silver-plated connector on the left side, silver-plated patch on the left side and the right side, that gets soldered directly down to the board. And if you had, for instance, a 603 component, 0603 is a popular size of surface mount resistor. that means it is 60 thou long and 30 thou wide. That's what the 0603 means. It's a fractions of an inch. A 1206 is 0.12 inches long and 0.06 inches wide. So the numbers on most of these things indicate the size. And except for the really big ones, like the 1206s, everything from 603 and 402 and so on, without magnification, it's very difficult to do the dotting. If you can do it under a stereo zoom microscope with some skill, with some learning curve, it's doable. What the really smart people do, and let me drop, is the printed circuit board says that R42 is supposed to go here, and R42 is a 10K resistor, and it's an 0603 size. So you go to the appropriate package, you open it up, you stick your little bitty tweezers in the package, and you pick out one of those 0603 resistors. You put it under the microscope and you double check that it says 104 on it. 104 means 103, I guess it would be. 10 and 30 is 103, would tell you it's a 10K resistor. That what some of the guys then is they take some kind of sticky stuff, like this, I can't think of the name of the stuff that comes in a stick. It's a white stick that you rub on a piece of paper and it makes two pieces of paper stick together. So with a toothpick, you take a small dab of that, you dab it in the middle of the resistor, not near the contact, in the middle, and you stick the resistor down on the board, and hopefully the sticky stuff will stop it from moving. And then with a hot soldering iron, you solder one end first, and that holds it down, then you solder the other end. If you don't do that, my goodness, are you going to have the so-called tiddlywink problem. When you're using the tweezers, you got to be very careful you don't squeeze them too much. You really should build a moat on the bench where you're doing the working. You build a fence around the thing that you're working on your clean fence, on your clean bench, because there's a 50-50 chance the first few times you try to solder one of these things down, just like doing a tiddlywinks game, it jumps off to some great distance, and if there isn't a fence to catch it, you're going to be crawling around on your hands and knees trying to find that darn tiny little part on the floor. And I've spent a lot of my life doing that. Another approach I've used is to put a small dab of solder on one of the contacts on the PC board. And so I then hold the component with the tweezers, lay the component on top of that solder blob, hit it with the soldering iron, which brings it down to the board. Once one end of the component is soldered, you're in good shape. Now something is holding it, and you can take your own sweet time soldering the other end. But that very first solder contact, before you get the component in the right component in the right position.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Before you get the right component in the right position, without it jumping off to infinity in distance somewhere, and solder down one end, it's a bit of a pain. When you're operating with micro-miniature parts like this, say for instance the part is sitting on the board, but it's 0.005 of an inch lower than where you want it. It's not properly centered. Common sense would lead you to believe you look through the microscope, you bring your tweezers up to the component, you gently push it on one side to move it to 0.005 of an inch in order to center it. You think you're going to do that. With an ordinary size resistor on a printed circuit board, that's exactly what would happen. With these micro-miniature surface mount components, you come near the thing and touch it. There's a 50-50 chance you try to move it 0.005 of an inch and it'll jump 0.025 of an inch. And I'm not kidding. They really are persnickety little things. There's a whole skill set required in order to keep them from jumping out of the field of operation, being lost forever, to properly get them oriented. And by the way, the first time you lay it down, it'll always jump upside down, where the component value is now invisible, and you try to, with your tweezers, grab it very gently and turn it over. You'd be amazed how difficult it is the first few times you do it. If you're not doing it with some kind of visual magnification, back in the days when I was 20 years of age and I could focus at the end of my nose and I could bring my nose that close to the printed circuit board, yes, I could do it without magnification. Everything beyond 30 years of age, If I wanted to work on surface mount components, I'd better be using some kind of visual magnification. And the best kind of all is a stereo zoom microscope with the right kind of lighting. So just know that there's a significant learning curve in using these things. I wonder if you've been through some of this jazz, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. I have attempted to do some service on a couple of them, and like you say, it's tough. What I found that I have, what helped a lot, I made up a little jig, and as Vic said, he's using that little sticky component supposedly in spot, in place. What I have is I made up something that works for me a little better. I don't know, maybe may not be for everybody. But it's actually a stick that comes across from an upright piece of dowel, and the thing is sits on the bench, a piece of a square piece of plywood or shelving, whatever you like to use. And the board sits on that, and then its arm comes up from the back and extends across. And on the end of this arm is variable. The arm is actually held with rubber band. So it pushes down on this one piece on the vertical piece of it, which is a pencil. I use a pencil with a eraser, and I cut the eraser so it's very narrow. But the rubber of the eraser is able to sort of hold the component in place, leaving my hands free. Once I position it, I can slide it a little bit. As Dick says, it'll take off like you go to squat a mosquito. It's just being, it's gone. But this thing holds it. In other words, this little jig I made up with using rubber band, it holds the component vertically down on that spot on the board. Carefully, I can sometimes just flip it back and forth to where I want it. And then it leaves both my hands free to do the soldering. That's what I found works best for me. Let me let it drop on me. All right, I made some experiments. I want to do some, little projects using surface mount technology. And what I did is I took a piece of board, and basically if you have a steady enough hand, you can make landing, like violence, with a Dremel tool on a piece of printed circuit board. In other words, you're making these little islands of each, and components sit between these two islands. Just be careful. I have what they call an XY type of piece of machinery that's meant for precision milling. So I was able to cut some very nice little patterns on the board and then just lay the component on it, like I just mentioned, solder it up. It takes practice, lots of practice. But this is the technology of today, so you will find, I'm sure, as we go on, the old technology of printed circuits, top and bottom components one side, soldered on the other side, is just going to basically vanish. This is the technology of from here on, I believe, because they are going to put definitely circuits, if possible, on both sides, and many times layers of circuits. Back to you, Dick.
QC2, QAQ. Very good, Ben Mel. I got a lot of comments on what Mel just said. Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
I just wanted to mention, everything I do is surface mount, and a lot of the techniques that you're mentioning definitely work, but something I found works for me all the time, and I do surface mount only.
Glenn has really got something there. When it comes to removing a surface mount component because you think it's damaged, you got the wrong one in the wrong place, or whatever, to use a soldering iron on the left side of the component and a soldering iron on the right side of the component. Two separate soldering irons, one in each hand, very fine soldering irons. And you melt both sides of the solder simultaneously. Beautiful way of removing the component. Other than that, the only way to get a component off the board is you must get rid of every single bit of the solder. If you're not willing to break the component, which sometimes damages the board, by the way, by using solder wick, you can wick away the solder very thoroughly on each side. Then you can remove the component. But the two soldering iron technique is a very good one. The sticky substance I have to use, and the holding device made out of a pointy eraser on a holding device that Mel uses, the reason for that, that as the component becomes smaller and smaller, let me drop, the amount of capillary reaction you get starts becoming huge. In other words, you've got the component in the right position, you laid it on the board, and you made sure you didn't touch the board, because just touching the board will create a vibration that'll make the component move three steps over to another place. So you got the component in the right position, you're about to solder down the left-hand side of the component, you got a little bit of solder in your left hand, you got the soldering iron in your right hand, you're heating up the left-hand junction of the component and the place where it touches the pre-C board, and you melt some solder in that location, and you see the solder flow between the component, the soldering iron, the board, and now you got a nice field of solder. You start bringing the soldering iron away. The capillary action of the solder and soldering iron will quite a few times make the component follow the soldering iron, and it comes away with you. And now you got the component and a blob of solder stuck on the end of the iron, and you're starting to use strong, faulty language. Been down that road many times. Mel gets around it by having a holding device that clamps the component in position. I do it by having a blob of solder in the right position first, so that my right hand is holding on to the tweezers and the component, my left hand is holding on to the soldering iron. I lay the component onto that little bitty blob of solder that I've already put on that terminal, and I melt the two together on the left side. Once the left side is soldered down, I've got it made. Now I can take my own sweet time and solder down the right-hand side. But that component really doesn't want to be where you want to put it. It wants the tombstone, it wants to flip over, it wants to jump to some other position, it wants to follow your soldering iron. And by the way, as the components get smaller and smaller, the problem becomes worse and worse. The smallest components I know of, they go from 804, 603, 402, 201. 20 thou by 10 thou. When you see a plastic bag full of 0201 components, you think you're looking at finely ground salt grains in a plastic package. That's what they really look like. And if you're not using a whole lot of magnification, your chances of being able to work with those is awfully slim. But as you get more and more compact printed circuit
repeaters,
as you get more and more compact printed circuit boards with higher and higher density, you're going to find them using smaller and smaller boards. I have seen a bunch of PC boards with all kinds of integrated circuits and 0402s and 0201 components around them. Until you look at that PC board under a microscope, you don't know what the world you're looking at. It looks like a PC board that somebody made a little bit bumpy. And it's got a whole lot of real components down there. It is a skill that takes some time to learn. Each one of us with your particular available hardware are going to find ways of holding down the components. But you better, in the beginning, build a fence around the thing, a moat as I call it, to catch the parts when they tiddlywink, when they jump off to some ridiculous distance. You think you're holding it with the tweezers, and the tweezers flip a little bit, and the component that you were trying to position to the nearest couple thousandths of an inch just moved a foot away. That's a huge distance when you're working microscopically. But you've got some further comments on this, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ, with one more comment.
Okay, yeah. Glenn first, then Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
You know, just one other thing I thought of while I was listening to you.
Okay, so you chip away an awful lot of the solder flux, and depending on what brand of solder you're using, that can work pretty well. I've had a medium amount of success by using alcohol and an acid brush, and in some cases a cotton swab. But alcohol usually dissolves the fluxes that I've used, although life is getting complicated. One of the things I'm discovering that I really don't like is, what do they call it now? Rohan, removal of hazardous materials. The lead-free solders are a pain. They've got a characteristic where they don't wick onto the PC board anywhere near as nicely as ordinary solder. And certain military organizations are discovering that Rohat lead-free solder is a hazard. It's a hazard to making good contacts. It grows tin whiskers inside of your printed circuits, inside of your integrated circuits. So there are a number of military programs that say you will not use Rohat components on this program. So there's a huge conflict of interest going on. There's a bunch of real busybodies out there running around the world getting rid of all the rolls of solder we used to have that worked like a charm. 6040 or eutectic 6337 solder, ordinary lead tin solder. There's a bunch of people running around trying to remove all the lead-bearing solder in the world. And the lead-bearing solder works like a charm when you're assembling a component, a PC board. And these so-called lead-free solders, I wonder how much of those you've used, Glenn. I'm about to ask you. I've had a lot of trouble with them. Over to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, unfortunately, everything I had to do today is all lead-free. It requires much higher temperatures. The processes are very, very different. But what I've been noticing, you know, in the beginning, it was really horrible, getting used to working with it. For us, to be honest with you, Vic, in my lab, generally we do not use, especially for our prototypes and, test circuits.
Now, you find that the lead-free solder destroys the board. Is that because it's got a more vigorous flux that eats into the board? Is that what's going? And the higher temperatures, I guess, also damage the board faster. And the higher temperatures must also be rough on the components. Is this some of what's going on, Glenn?
What question?
Station recognized. Let me just answer this real quick, Dick. But mainly, when you're doing a lot of component changes and designing, and you're trying and experimenting with things, you might be using a board many, many times and switching components around many, many times. So we're better off with the lower temperature solders.
Yep. There's a number of people, and I'm one of them, are running around now trying to hoard lead-free solder. I mean the ordinary lead-tin solder, because it's so much easier to work with. W2RYY, you got it, Joe.
Hi, I've been listening to a conversation about soldering these SMR components type of thing. Does the heat rating of these components actually change as the size of the component gets smaller? In other words, it'll take so many seconds of heat at a certain temperature?
I think generally the answer is no. If I had a pretty good size 603 resistor, and then for whatever reason I'm able to use a 0402 or 0201 resistor, they take the same amount of heat for the same length of time. Resistors don't have a temperature problem when it comes to a soldering iron. Capacitors, maybe they do. Transistors certainly do. So when it comes to the really small integrated circuits with the extremely high temperature of the lead-free solders, my guess is it takes a lot of skill. In other words, you better have the component glued down with some of the PRIT stuff, P-R-I-T, I think it is, this paper sticking glue. You better have the component held down so it doesn't move. You better hit it with a soldering iron for as absolutely brief a period as you possibly can. Otherwise, I think you're in danger of damaging the component. That's my belief. Let's see what Glenn feels on that one. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. The component that really is the problem. As a matter of fact, even we don't see component higher temperature solders. The biggest problem, I've been out to, seen the China facility solder profiles. Years ago, they used to use a thing called wave solder. You know, you had a big pool of solder, boards went down a conveyor belt, and you had a solder-sided board. Still widely used, but boy, is that very, very difficult to do because you have to pre-solder mask and right down to the component, and the solder is actually put on as a piece. Processes are very good, but case and chips like this.
My guess is the component is being heated for quite a significant period of time with that reflow process. I think it's essentially hot air that's being aimed at the component, the glue, the solder preform, and you're soldering them all together. My guess is that core component is being heated up for 30 solid seconds in that process. Is that approximately right, Glenn?
very good. Yeah, actually, yeah, it is. But it's there again. I haven't seen the problem where we've lost any components or seen any reduction in reliability. The first thing they're doing is they're always coming back to engineering, and I have to work with my mechanical group a lot. The quality of the solder joints and making the right connections.
Fun process. The good news is our printed circuit boards are getting smaller and smaller. Depending on what company you work at, they usually have a collection box somewhere where they collect batteries so you don't just throw them into the garbage. And one of the companies I work at, they have a box where they collect cell phones that people are discharging that are no longer using. You go to the defunct or discarded cell phones and take one apart and look what's inside with a good microscope. It'll blow your mind. You find a large number of integrated circuits on both sides of the PC board. A whole bunch of resistors, capacitors, and integrated circuits on both sides of the PC board. When you study the edge of the PC board, you'll find that the PC board has got 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 layers to it with plated through holes connecting all of the circuitry of the various layers to the actual active components that are on the surface. My goodness, is that compact. Sometimes they've got a layer of the 7-layer board which is grounding between the RF ground and the B-plus ground. I mean, there'll be one whole layer of grounding, one for B-plus, for power supplies, another layer of grounding for RF circuitry, and so on. Very sophisticated. You're looking at fifth-generation hardware, in my opinion. So it's a real eye-opener to take an ordinary cell phone that someone has thrown away. I don't care if it's been thrown down a flight of stairs or they just put it in the box saying, I'm not using it anymore. You take it apart, and boy, you get an eye-opener. K2KEY for any of the above, K2RIW.
And it says K2KEY, yes, I have been there with that. I found in the street somebody lost one iPod, and it got run over by a car to bed. And the thing was pretty mashed, but I took it up, I can say, mind-boggling what's in there. But getting back to one more thing, I mean, you know, just a little servicing I've done on, I haven't been, you know, involved any more really in the that end of the business of prototyping and all that goodies anymore, because my day you could use basically when I should have stopped blowing. We got away from the Weller 250 watt soldering gun. But all honesty, what I do, I for instance now, if I had to remove one of those little resistors or capacitors, which I have done, and now I service, like I said, some little small items. My unique way of taking off like a resistor, I have a number of pairs of tweezers, lots of very fine tweezers. And what I do is I put a rubber band around the tweezers to keep them closed so that when I press on it, it opens the tweezer, of course. I put it onto the resistor or the little capacitor that I want to remove. I have a little piece of string attached to the tweezer, which I hold between my teeth. And then with two soldering irons, I use both sides and just lift my head gently. How I pull off the components. I know you must think I'm crazy, but that's the way I found it. I can take the component off very clean without damaging the board. Over.
Fantastic. That man has created a third hand. That's a good idea. I'm going to use that one. I've got a supply of rubber bands, I've got a supply of fine tweezers, and I've got some lacing cord, which is going to be a poor man's equivalent of string. And so I've always needed a third hand to lift the component when I'm using the two soldering irons. When I'm removing a component and I don't want to take the time of wicking away all the solder. I'm forced to do all the wicking job, which only is partially successful, because there's always a little bit of solder left. The only other thing I've had some success with is moving the soldering iron back and forth between left side and right side real fast so that I heat up both sides with one iron as if I had two irons. And my other hand has got the tweezers on the component. I've had some success with that. So that's a crafty idea. Not crazy at all. Back to you, Mel. and maybe you can go on to the next one if you want to. K2RAW.
Can I just make some more little comments about what you're talking about?
Go ahead, Joe.
I believe I've seen it in catalogs like Tesco, which sells a lot of different types of test equipment and stuff for their electronics industry. I believe they sell something called a heated tweezers that has a way of heating both sides of the surface mount device simultaneously. To get over, I think the tips on these things are changeable to pretty much try to match the device as far as the size. Where you can pretty much do it like one-handed, heat the thing up, pull it over one-handed. It's got to be a lot easier than using two soldering irons.
Yep, the tweezers are a good idea. There must be some kind of a fixture someone made where the tip of the soldering iron spreads out into two points, so to speak, that have just the right spacing, and heat up left and right side of the component simultaneously. I know they make an equivalent like that for disconnecting certain kinds of multi-pin integrated circuits, like a quadradecapede or a hexadecapede. What is it now? Now you've got 14-pin. Yeah, that's a quadradecapede. The 14-pin integrated circuit. They make a device that'll heat up all 14 pins simultaneously. So there are tools, and boy, you need tools when you're doing this kind of work. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, you look in the catalog. This is K2KEY. You look in the catalog there, and they have some equipment for working on printed circuits that are mind-boggling. The price is also quite mind-boggling. So, you're not in a profession where you require things like this. I guess that's why it's come to a throwaway situation with most of the boards, with small boards and all. And I guess it's not cost-effective just to sit there and have a technician try to repair them. They just take them out and throw them away. Now, you were mentioning Rohat. Dick, any of these companies now that are advertising, like IBM and all, that have gone so-called green, they are really using this as part of their commercials and everything, like IBM, will not accept anything that has lead in it. Did you know that, over?
Yep, I'm hearing that. But the lead-free solders are creating an awful lot of problems. Whenever lead-free solder gets into certain environments, particularly in space, the tin... Is it the tin? Yeah, it's the tin that's in the lead-free solder that suddenly starts migrating. In the presence of lead, it behaves. In the absence of lead, the tin starts growing whiskers, and it creates short circuits. And so, you haven't heard the end of the story yet. There's an awful lot of grief being created by so-called green lead-free solders. Over to you, Mel.
Roger. I guess it's just a matter of time before... it will all be lead free, unfortunately. And yes, you and I, a few others, are hoarding solder. I have a number of rolls of different gauge solder that I put. I can work on my own little projects and work with what I'm familiar with. But the future is not there with lead solder, Dick. They will not accept it anymore. I've gotten this from a number of people that told me that don't even submit proposal unless you specify that this is going to be so-called green, flammable. You know, like you say, throwing your cell phones into the batch, their batteries into the batch. Everything is going to have to be recycled. So this is the situation now that we're faced more and more in the next few years. Even the question now was of the hybrid cars, that the batteries, if it came up with a battery that would be extremely efficient, unless it's recyclable, it will never come on the market, Dick, over.
Yep, I can see the problem. And when it comes to pure electric cars, from what I'm hearing, they're having a very tough time getting beyond 40 miles before you turn on the gas engine. So, a plug-and-play automobile is a great-sounding advertisement, so to speak, but to get anywhere near the energy density that you get from a couple of gallons of a petroleum product, boy, it is a lot of energy in that petroleum. And to try to pack that amount of energy in that number of cubic inches or pounds of stuff by way of batteries, it is tough. So, yes, there's going to be improvements in batteries. We're going to get a 2-to-1 improvement. Are we going to get the 100-to-1 improvement that we need? The 10-to-1 improvement that we need? I mean, a good modern automobile, carefully driven.